Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and thanks for joining us for this episode of New Books in Philosophy, which is part of the New Books Network. I'm Robert Talese. I'm professor of philosophy at Vanderbilt University. I co-host the program with Carrie Figder, Malcolm Keating, and Sarah Tyson. My guest today is Katerina Dutil-Novais. Katerina is professor of philosophy and university research chair at Vrije University Amsterdam. She's also a professorial fellow at ARCE at the University of St. Andrews. Katerina specializes in the philosophy of logic and the philosophy of mathematics, including the history of logic and argumentation theory. In addition to all that, she also pursues work in social epistemology, philosophical psychology, and political philosophy. Her new book has just been published with Cambridge University Press. It's titled The Dialogical Roots of Deduction: Historical, Cognitive, and Philosophical Perspectives on Reasoning. Now, if all men are mortal and Socrates is a man, then it must be that Socrates is mortal. What could be more obvious than that? Well, sometimes obviousness serves to conceal difficulties, and there's a lot more going on in this simple deduction than we often recognize. For one thing, we're not being asked to assess whether all men indeed are mortal. Nor are we asking whether Socrates is indeed a man when we're running this inference. Instead, we're focusing on the logical relation that obtains between those two claims and the third, namely that Socrates is mortal. We claim that the third statement follows from the combination or conjunction of the first two, or that the third is entailed by the combination or conjunction of the first two. But what's that? How does that work? It seems like magic, doesn't it? So despite the obviousness of deduction, there are all kinds of philosophical questions that need addressing. And in her new book, Katerina argues that deduction arises out of practices of dialogue. Now, as usual, there's a lot to talk about, but we should also begin, as we normally do, with our author and guest. Hi, Katerina. How are you?
Hi, Bob. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining us on New Books in Philosophy. So we usually ask the author to begin, start us off with telling us a bit about themselves. So can you tell us a bit about yourself, Katerina?
Sure. Well, so I was born and raised in Brazil. I actually also spent 2 years of my teen years in high school in France. And so that's basically where, I was formed as a person, right between Brazil and France, and also in France. In these 2 years in France, this is really where my love for mathematics first emerged, and that's one of the motivations for writing this whole book. So that's why I think it's kind of relevant to mention. Then after that, I studied mathematics and philosophy and mathematics. So major in philosophy, minor in mathematics at the University of São Paulo, which is my hometown. And then I moved in 1999. I moved to the Netherlands. First to do a master's degree in logic at the University of Amsterdam. And I just ended up staying in the Netherlands, so I've been here since. I then went on to write a PhD thesis on Latin medieval logic, right? So I really started my career a historian of logic. But I was already also very interested in using, say, modern logical tools to study these historical logical theories. So I worked a lot on formalization. That's also something I've thought a lot about. And so after that, I also spent almost two years in New York. And my hangout place in New York was the CUNY Graduate Center, right? So that's also your alma mater.
Yes.
But we didn't overlap. I think you were gone already by then. But I have heard about you already even back then. You know, your reputation was still...
They can't prove any of it.
No, that's true. But I mean, your presence was still felt. Let's put it like that. And yeah, it was a really nice time. I really liked the Graduate Center a lot at the time. After that, so I then went back to the Netherlands and I've been, you know, doing my thing ever since here. You know, I was in the University of Amsterdam, then I spent 7 years at the University of Groningen. And now since 2018, I'm at the Free University in Amsterdam. And so I've worked on a number of different things. I've worked on, as I said, I started working on Latin medieval logic. But then my first postdoc project was on paradoxes, so comparing modern and medieval solutions to the paradoxes. After that, I worked on notations and formalization and what exactly the cognitive impact is of using notations when you're doing logic, when you're doing mathematics. And that the result of that project was a book called Formal Languages and Logic. And this book came out in 2012, also with Cambridge University Press. And after that, my next project, because here in the Netherlands, we, you know, if you're lucky, you get those big grants, you know, that fund mm-hmm. fund research for quite a few years. And so my project after the one on formal languages was called The Roots of Deduction. And it's mm-hmm. exactly the project that then led to me writing this whole book. And there really the question was, you know, well, let's try to understand what deduction is all about, because as you mentioned in your introduction, it seems simple, but it's not. And so I really wanted to approach the question of deduction from different angles. So historically, philosophically, formally, but also from the point of view of cognition and also the point of view of mathematical practices. And I felt we really needed this kind of, you know, synthetic approach to make sense of these questions that are very puzzling, which we'll be talking about today, I suppose.
Well, that's fabulous. Let's begin at the beginning. And I should say just straight away that this is a really fabulous book. And even for a person like me who's not an expert, or this is not, you know, philosophy of logic is not my research area, although I occasionally teach logic.
Well, I think you're being overly modest here, but okay.
this was a real delight to read. So let's begin at the beginning. You identify sort of three key features of deduction or deductive inferences. Can you tell us what they are and then describe for us how when deduction is understood a little bit more precisely, you know, you could see all of the points at which philosophical troubles begin to emerge.
Right. Yes. Yeah, so I distinguish three main features in the book indeed. And these are the cornerstones for the whole investigation in the book. The first property of a deductive argument or deductive reasoning is necessary truth preservation. Of course, nobody's surprised by that one, because this is also what distinguishes deduction from other forms of inference and argument, for example, inductive inference or abduction. Mm-hmm. So it's really the idea that when, you know, if you have premise A and B and then there's a conclusion C, which follows deductively from A and B, then C has to be true if A and B are true. There's absolutely no exception, right? It has to be the case. So that property is quite puzzling. And so that's definitely, but at the same time, you know, widely recognized as being one of the main, or perhaps even the main feature of deduction. So yeah. Nobody disputes that. But my point in the book was also to emphasize that there are at least two other features that are also extremely important, which tend to be under-theorized in these discussions on philosophy of logic. And these are, the second one is what I call perspicuity, which is, right, so it's taken also from the Wittgensteinian idea of Übersichtlichkeit. Mm-hmm. And so the thought is that a deductive argument has to be, is actually a stepwise procedure, right? So you don't go from premises straight to conclusion, right? If a mathematician does this, people are going to say, look, this is a terrible proof, right? We're not buying this. So you really need to go in this stepwise way. And how detailed you're going to be will depend on the intended audience of your proof, right? But even when it's very condensed, there's still this idea that it's a stepwise procedure, right? And so, and the idea is that each of these steps should be sufficiently clear for the intended audience so that they will actually, when they run through, when they go through the different steps in the right order, eventually they'll see how the premises are connected to the conclusion. So that aspect is very important. And finally, the third aspect that I emphasize is the idea that, at least in its simplest formulation, right, its kind of most basic formulation, the game of deduction is played with no involvement of your own beliefs, right? So you're not, what you yourself think of the premises should play no role at all when you're evaluating the validity of a deductive argument, right? So this is just an example that I give in the book. If you start with something like, you know, all cows are blue, all blue things are made of stone. So what's the conclusion? All cows are made of stone. And if you say this, for example, which I have done, say, for example, to a class of high school students, they look at you and they think you're nuts, right? Why would anyone even bother about an argument that's just so preposterous? And the whole point is, of course, that for us, is really, if you're looking at deduction from this point of view of validity, you don't care, right? What people think or do not think about the premises. And this is actually something, on the one hand, you might say, well, that's pretty obvious. Why do we even have to make that explicit? But actually, this is cognitively very difficult, right? People really tend to hold on to the beliefs they already have and evaluate arguments on the basis of their own doxastic attitudes towards, in particular, the conclusion, but also the premises. So it was important, I thought, to distinguish these three features, right, of deduction, and use them to discuss, you know, different manifestations of the phenomena that I was interested in. And then you asked me about, like, what are the questions, right? Why is this a problem? Why did I even bother writing a whole book, right, about deduction?
Right.
Haven't we figured it out already long ago? Well, we haven't, right? So this is the whole point. And the thing is that even though, of course, deduction has been around for millennia, so I in the book I claim that the first theoretical articulation of the notion of deduction is to be found in Aristotle in the Pre-Analytics. Mm-hmm. And I also, by the way, discuss other logical traditions, but that all happened a little later. So I think it's still fair to say that, you know, even in world history, Aristotle was the first who codified the notion of deduction. But even right in the terms of the notion of what we now call syllogisms. But even early on, for example, Sextus Empiricus and others, they were already thinking there's something fishy about deduction. You know, what's going on here? And one of the worries has been that deduction doesn't seem to be very useful, right? Because the thought is that you have to, you know, when you're reasoning or when you're right, when you're what you want is to expand the knowledge that you already have, right? So you start with certain premises. And then you want to go beyond the knowledge containing those premises for your inference to be useful. So in, for example, a typical example what people call an ampliative inference would be something like an inductive inference, right? Where the knowledge, the information contained in the conclusion goes beyond what is contained on the premises. But deduction does not have this feature, right? Because the whole point is precisely that, in a sense, the conclusion is already contained in the premises. So there's this tension between the validity, the notion of deductive validity, and the usefulness that a deductive argument may or may not have. And that's something, right? So I mentioned Sextus Empiricus, but also somebody like Descartes also said, well, you know, when he was talking about scholastic logic, he said, well, this is really just a logic, a way of expounding to others what one already knows. It's not a logic of discovery. I don't discover new truths by using, say, scholastic logic, right? So this idea has been around for many, for centuries. And more recently, people like Hintikka, for example, he formulated this in terms of the scandal of deduction, right? So how is it, how can a deductive argument be informative and valid at the same time? So this is one of the problems, right, that I address in the book. I mean, there are a few others. I don't know if you want me to go on and mention a few others?
Could you mention a couple of the others? I think that they'll come in handy later.
Yes. So one of them, another one is, you know, how ubiquitous is deduction really, right? So where do we find deduction? Is it all around us, right? Does everybody engage regularly in deductive reasoning in their daily lives? Yes or no? So many traditional philosophers like to think that, yes, deduction is everywhere. But if you look at a lot of the experimental work that's been done for decades on the psychology of reasoning, you see that people do quite poorly in deductive reasoning experiments. And that is, of course, you know, puts pressure on the idea that deduction is everywhere. But if deduction is not everywhere, right, for example, in a Kantian way, you might say, well, Kant thinks that logic, you know, provides the conditions for thought as such, right? And so that seems to imply that deductive reasoning would be a bit pretty much everywhere. But then when you start seeing these results, these experimental results that seem to suggest that people are not very good deductive reasoners, that really puts pressure, right, on this idea that deduction should really be the kind of the foundation, provides the foundation for reasoning as such, for thought as such. And so then you have the question, do we then want to conclude that the deduction is nowhere, right? That it was something like phlogiston, right? Something that we're theorizing about, but just simply does not exist. And I don't want to go as far as that, right? So in the book, I say it's not really like phlogiston, but it's not nearly as widespread as, you know, other people have claimed it to be. So that's another problem. And the other problem has to do with the very nature of deductive necessity, right? Which is really what is so fundamental about deductive arguments when compared to other kinds of arguments. And you really get into all kinds of difficult philosophical problems when you try to make sense of the nature of this necessity. Why is it that, you know, if Socrates is a human and all humans are mortal, why is it that it's necessarily the case that Socrates will be immortal? So there are many different, you know, takes on this, on what, you know, the nature of deductive necessity in the literature, but I really think that none of them has really kind of cracked the puzzle for us. So I thought that at least for these three problems that I've just mentioned, really, you know, indicated that there's still, you know, we still need to think about deduction from, you know, from a philosophical perspective more carefully.
Great. That's fabulous. And just picking up on that, so you describe in one of the chapters, early chapters goes into a couple of the, you know, competing accounts of the nature of the entailment relation, or the nature of, you know, the relation that that upholds in a valid deductive inference. You know, some of them rely on models and this sort of thing. And you find them sort of insufficient in addressing some of the philosophical questions that emerge out of the nature of deduction, and that we need to look at dialogue for the root of deduction. You know, can you give us the sort of the big picture here that the book is aimed at advancing?
Yeah, so the big picture, I guess, the main enemy of the book, as it were, right? So the view that the book mostly criticizes is the idea that deductive reasoning is something that pertains to the mental realm, right? Pertains to thinking, pertains to kind of the individual realm of thoughts, right? And this is something that you see, especially where we started this idea of like this connection between logic and thought, is something that kind of already started a bit in the Latin Middle Ages, but really got consolidated with Descartes and other early modern thinkers. And then it culminates with Kant. Right, this meant what I call a mentalistic conception of logic, right, as pertaining to mental events to thought, and so one of the main thing that I claim in the book is that this is wrong, right? That if you really want to understand logic and deduction, you need to go back to the root, the historical roots of deduction, which are through and through dialogical. So that's the big kind of disagreement that I have with a lot of the more traditional views. And then but that's at this very philosophical level. But also in the literature on philosophy of logic of the last many decades, the main approaches have been model theoretical accounts of logical consequence and proof theoretical accounts of logical consequence. So now we're already looking at kind of technical approaches, right? Technical frameworks to try to kind of tame the very notion of deduction, right? Whereas before I was talking about like the, you know, the more philosophical level of what deduction is all about. And these two approaches, right, both the theoretical approaches and proof theoretical approaches, I mean, there's been a lot of super interesting technical work. And I mean, I've also kind of done work a bit on both the philosophical discussions around both traditions. But I claim in the book that neither of them really, gets at the heart of the whole thing, right? Really, in the end, they both kind of run into all kinds of problems. And these problems are recognized in the literature. So it's not so much that I'm the first one saying, well, see, the proof, the model theoretical account has these problems and the proof theoretical account has those problems. These remarks or these diagnoses are already available in the literature. And the problem is that we seem to be kind of stuck in this situation where, you know, we both, like, there are good arguments against each of these approaches, and the other side doesn't really manage to kind of give a proper reply. So it seems like, you know, we're stuck and we need a new perspective to get, you know, these discussions moving. It's like a bit of a stalemate that has been reached, you know, where, and it's also not clear what kind of evidence we can rely on to decide these disputes between, say, model theoretical accounts and proof theoretical accounts. So, you know, so that's why I thought, well, we need a gestalt shift, right? We need a different perspective. And let me, you know, propose this dialogical conception of deduction to see where it takes us.
Great. You know, this happens often, I guess, in philosophical disputes where there's a certain point where two competing accounts just, just sit alone eating their bullets, you know, chewing on the bullets that they have to bite. And that's sort of, you know, where things kind of hang out. You know, things are in a holding pattern because everyone's just, you know, chewing on the bullets each of them has to bite.
Exactly. And then you, at some point you just get bored.
Yeah, that's right. And, but as you say, and, you know, the motivating problem that created the two camps and the crossfire between them, still remains unsolved, right?
Yes. And then my proposal will be that, right, so my framework accommodates the insights of both, right? So that's why it's more like, you know, well, we're both right to some extent, but also wrong to some extent. So, right. Yeah.
Fantastic. So let's get into the proposal. So we are, you're asking us to look at the root of deduction, which you claim is in, dialogical practices, discourses. And then you think that, or you propose to us that we can think of deduction as emerging out of what you call prover-skeptic games. Can you explain how those games comport with or fit in with the three features of deduction, and how understanding deduction as the sort of the byproduct or the something that emerges out of these kinds of special kinds of dialectical exchanges addresses some of the philosophical problems with deduction?
Yes. So first of all, I mean, as I mentioned, right, the hypothesis, the dialogical hypothesis, is very much inspired by the historical development of deduction in ancient Greece in particular. But actually, as I mentioned, I also talk about Indian logic and Chinese logic a bit in the book. And you see something similar. And the thought is that both in logic and philosophy and in mathematics, it's really practices of debating, dialogical practices that are, you know, at the, that provide the conditions, the social, political, cultural conditions for the emergence of argumentative practices, which then in turn went on to develop into deductive argumentative practices. So that's the historical motivation. But when I speak of the roots of deduction, I mean it also in a broader sense. I also mean in a cognitive sense, right? So I spent quite a bit of time in the book talking about how best to learn to reason deductively, right? So when I claim that it's better to approach it dialogically, but also so philosophically, right? So it's really the idea of roots is quite broad here. And it's inspired, by the way, by Quine, right? So the roots of reference. So maybe some people have made a connection already or not. But while Quine thinks of the root of reference, so roots of reference really only at the level of what he himself called the psychogenesis of reference, my sense of roots is broader. And so that was the kind of the initial motivation for the book. And then for the investigation, right? And then but of course, I'm not the first person in recent times to have proposed, right, a dialogical approaches to logic. So I have some predecessors in the 20th century, and I also discuss them. In particular, Lorentzen, right, with the German school of dialogical logic, and also Jaakko Hintikka's game theoretical semantics are the two main examples that I discuss. And so of course, this idea has been kind of floating a bit in the air. And this, they were, by the way, fundamentally inspired by developments in game theory. Right? So the emergence of game theory was an important factor, right, for the development of these dialogical approaches. But so then, and the other person that has been an important influence for me is Lakatos, and right, so with the idea of proofs and refutations. And so Lakatos, for those of you who remember, right, so he has this idea that mathematical knowledge is produced by, you know, through the interplay between somebody putting forward a proof, a conjecture, and then other people coming up with all kinds of objections to the way the proof is formulated. And then the initial formulation of the proof then gets revised. And he claims that this is how mathematical knowledge is essentially produced. And so you can think about, right, so in this sense of the proofs and refutations dynamic, as if it would be involving two characters, the prover and the refuter, right? Somebody's doing the proof and somebody else is coming up with objections and refuting steps of the proof. And so in the book, I claim that I think the refuter, thus understood, is just too narrow as a character. And that's why I propose instead the idea of the skeptic. And this is also, again, something that's also this terminology was also already available in literature on computer science. So it's not a terminology that I invented. But I started using this terminology, prover skeptic. Whereas at the beginning, I was still using the Lorentzen terminology of proponent and opponent. And then I moved away from that. But prover skeptic really seemed to me to capture what I was after, right? So the idea there's somebody who's, they're functional terms, right? So somebody's putting forward a proof, that's the prover, and the skeptic is the one who's asking questions, is the inquirer, right? Mm-hmm. And the skeptic is not only in the business of coming up with counterexamples, right? So that's why it's not just a refuter. But the skeptic also has a very important job of asking for clarifications along the way to make sure that each of the steps of the proof is clear. Is perspicuous, and now you see already where I'm going, because this gives me a very straightforward connection with these three pillars of deduction that I mentioned at the beginning. So first of all, you have the idea of necessary truth preservation. How do you understand this in these games? Well, it means that every step in these dialogues has to be necessarily truth preserving, right? There can be no exceptions there are no exceptions in the sense that wherever the premises are the case, then the conclusion will also be the case for that particular step. And then if you just chain those steps that are individually necessarily truth-preserving, the idea is that the whole argument will also have this property. And the dialogical motivation for this is that the prover really wants arguments that are very difficult to refute, right? And these other approaches, dialogical approaches to logic that I just mentioned, Lorentzen and Hintikka, They conceived of these dialogues as essentially adversarial. They really thought that in Lorentzen's terms, the proponent and the opponent, they were really competing with each other, and it would be like a zero-sum game. One would win and the other would lose. And in that context, if you think about these dialogues in this way, it becomes very natural to think about necessity in terms of winning strategies, right? Mm. So characterizes a deductive argument is that it's a winning strategy for the one proposing the argument. There's nothing that the other can do to undermine, right, the steps. So the argument is indefeasible in this way. So that idea for necessity and it was an important inspiration for me, and I still think it's an interesting idea. But the point is that I don't think of these dialogues as zero-sum games. I actually think there's a very important component of cooperation between my two participants, right, prover and skeptic. And so I cannot use the notion of winning strategy in the way that these other authors did. And still, I think the idea of a very strong argument, an argument that's indefeasible, has an appeal in the context where you're trying to persuade somebody, right, of a different point of view. So in that sense, this dialogical explanation, right, rationale for the property of necessary truth preservation becomes quite natural. You just want your arguments to be really, really strong, right? So that you can persuade your interlocutor. That's for necessary truth preservation, for perspicuity. And by the way, then the corresponding moves by skeptic in this case to ensure, right, the property of necessary truth preservation is to come up with counterexamples if there are any, right? So it's the job of skeptic to make sure that each step is necessarily truth preserving in this way. And so for perspicuity, it's also the job, it's a different job for skeptic, namely that of making sure that each of the steps is very clear. And whenever there's a step that's just too quick, right? And skeptic goes like, I don't know, I'm just not, you know, this, I'm not getting this. It's too fast, too quick for me, or it looks fishy or whatever. Then skeptic goes on and says, but why? Why? You know, what's going on here? Can you break down this step into more, you know, more details? And finally, the third idea of you have to be kind of abstract away from your own beliefs with respect to the premises. From a dialogical perspective, it's very natural because it simply means that you should be able to draw conclusions from the positions of your interlocutors. So not your own positions, right? So when I'm talking to somebody, I should be able to also say what would follow from their own discursive commitments, which are not necessarily mine. And so this idea of detaching from your own position, it's particularly useful in these dialogical settings where you're also drawing conclusions from the position of the person you're talking to.
Right. So that complicates, though, part of what we're talking about when we're talking about the job that prover has does seem like it's a little bit more naturally tied to what prover wants to demonstrate.
Right? That's right.
So I guess that you're saying, prover does have that role, but there's this other role too, which is prover isn't only in the business of proving the things that he or she wants to show. There's also a role taking element that prover there's also a role-playing element of what prover does. Does that seem right? Or thinking into the other person's perspective. Is that right?
That's true, because the prover is always presenting an argument to a particular audience. There's always a target audience in mind, right? And this is, I use the term granularity for this, right? So how detailed should the proof be? How granular should it be? Well, it will depend on the audience, right? So prover is formulating a proof to a specific skeptic, to a specific audience. Right. So in this sense, you know, if you're a professional mathematician, the way you're going to formulate your proof, if you're talking to a peer, right, to a fellow mathematician, it's going to be very condensed, right? It's just going to be the main ideas and that's it. But if you're presenting a proof to students, of course, then you're going to be much more detailed. So of course, prover is also, right, modulating, right? So the shape and feel of the proof, adapting that towards the audience. But at the same time, what I claim in the book is that these are also dialogues of mixed motivations. So prover does want to prove, right? And I mean when I say the prover does want to prove, I'm talking about mathematical practice. So if you look at how mathematicians go about their business, there are a lot of incentives for them to come up with nice proofs. By the way, in fact, I mean that's really kind of supposed to be the ultimate test, right? A mathematician is a good mathematician if he or she comes up with interesting and innovative proofs. So there's a very strong incentive for that. But skeptic is not so much motivated by, you know, blocking the proof at all costs. That's not the thought. Skeptic is kind of more neutral in the story, but skeptic, the job of skeptic is really to ensure that it really is a good proof. And in that sense, skeptic is helping prover to formulate a proof that is sufficiently clear for the intended audience.
I see.
Right?
I see.
So it's in that sense that they're cooperating, even though, I mean, there's a certain amount of a slight disalignment of interests because prover really wants the proof to go through, right? For glory and fame and tenure and publications, right? And money. But at the same time, and a skeptic is more neutral with respect to that, right? So there's a slight misalignment of interests, but by and large, they're cooperating in this joint endeavor of producing a good proof for the community as a whole.
So great. That's very helpful. Can you tell us then how this model of understanding sort of how deductive inference emerges? How does that help us address some of the philosophical problems that deduction occasions?
Yes. So one of the problems that's been discussed quite a bit in the literature and philosophy of logic of the last 10, 20 years is the issue of the normativity of logic. So you may have heard of that, right? So there's this thought that, which is a Kantian idea, really, right? So that logic is normative for thought as such. And a lot of people try to make sense of what exactly the normative import of logic should be. And back in the 70s, Gil Harman wrote a very influential attack on this idea, right, in his book, Changing View. And so basically he said, well, it just doesn't work, this idea that logic should have a normative import for thought, because, you know, he had all kinds of arguments against this view. One of them is the clutter argument, right? The point of the idea is that there are too many things that follow from any given set of premises, and then they would end up clutter the mind if you were to really, really draw all the logical conclusions from a set of premises. I mean, he has a bunch of different arguments. And people have since have been trying to still make sense of the idea of normativity of logic. And so what I say, in fact, I've also published a paper on this early on in the project, and then also in the book, I go back to this. I say that, well, this is just this is the wrong way to think about the normativity of logic. The normativity of logic pertains not to thought, but it pertains to these dialogical practices. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't pertain to the mono-agent situation of somebody just, you know, managing their beliefs, right, and their thoughts by themselves. Rather, it pertains to the multi-agent situation of people arguing with each other in very specific kinds of dialogical games, right? I'm not even, by the way, that's probably important to mention this. I'm not saying that any dialogue, you know, out there in real life will actually be an instance of these prover-skeptic dialogues. No, they're very niche. They're very specific, right, to certain practices, in particular within mathematics and other theoretical fields. Right, but then the claim is that this whole idea of the normativity of logic really makes a lot more sense if you think about this normativity as pertaining to these dialogical practices rather than to thought. And then also the idea of the usefulness, right? Remember the one that I mentioned at the beginning, so that it looks like our argumentation of deduction, deductive argument is not going to be very useful because basically you already know the conclusion, right, before you engage in the deductive argument. And that's exactly what Descartes said. He said, well, it's only useful to expound to others what you already know. Exactly. That is the whole point. It's something that's particularly useful in these multi-agent situations of exchanging views and positions and trying to persuade other people, right? So then you immediately see that at the same time, the argument will be valid and perhaps not informative for the person who first formulated the argument. Right, even though usually to come up with a non-trivial deductive argument, like a mathematical proof, it's a lot of work, right? So it's definitely not, you know, straightforward at all. But it's mostly, you know, it's aimed for the consumption of somebody else, right? Who will then become convinced of the conclusion by running through the steps of the argument. So in this way, you see that a lot of these, you know, perennial problems about deduction and deductive reasoning, if you think about them from this dialogical angle, you see that a lot of the puzzlement and the difficulties seem to dissolve.
Right. Fabulous. So the second part of the book explores the history in thinking about deduction. And as you've already mentioned, although you start with some ideas that I suspect will be familiar to people listening to us right now, you also bring in traditions, Indian and Chinese, in logical thinking and working through right up through the medieval period. The historical story you tell about how deduction sort of develops in the history has a lot to do with sort of it's a kind of history of forgetting.
Yes.
It's sort of a history by which we come to forget. And in virtue of forgetting, we come to misunderstand what we're doing, if that makes sense.
Can you tell us a little bit
about that story? Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. So, I mean, just perhaps it's useful to mention that the way I kind of the methodological principle for for this historical part of the book is the idea of genealogy, right? The genealogical analysis, kind of in the Nietzschean sense, in the Foucaultian Nietzschean sense, where you just go back and then you kind of try to trace the different steps of transformation of these practices, right? So the interesting things, of course, and also very important to mention, is that while I claim that deductive practices started, you know, very closely related to dialogical practices, very early on, they also acquire non-dialogical features, for example, pertaining to writing, right? And say the use of particular notational tools and all that. So a lot, it changes a lot along the way. But my claim is that you still see very much traces of these dialogical origins. And by, as you say, by forgetting about them, that's why how we ended up in this situation where we're not really understanding what we're talking about, right? For lack of like an understanding of these historical developments that still shape both theories and practices of deduction now. And the story I tell there in a sense is not at all novel, right? I mean, I really locate the birth of deductive practices in ancient Greece, and in particular against the background of Athenian democracy. And I emphasize the importance of the political cultural context, right, of people debating with each other in the assembly and all that, and how important it was to be persuasive. And then I claim that, say, both Plato and Aristotle are actually reacting to a certain model of argumentation, which they attribute to the sophists. And they say that the sophists are only interested in persuasion and are not interested in truth, whereas they are interested in truth, but they also remain interested in persuasion, right? It has to be. They can't afford the luxury of not paying attention to persuasion in a context that still requires, you know, people to be political agents that are arguing with each other and trying to convince each other of their positions. And then, so then you have Aristotle, who is the first who codifies, right, these ideas, the dialogical practices in a logical system, first with the topics, which is not yet logic, but it's already a regimentation of these dialectical practices. And then, of course, in the prior analytics with syllogistic, then it's really becomes the first logical system as we know it. And I also talk quite a bit about Plato and also the idea of an elenchus. And I claim that an elenchus, right, a refutation, is a very important, historically speaking, a very important element in the emergence of a deduction. And then I claim that, you know, for many, many centuries, this idea of logic as essentially tied to dialogical practices remained the dominant conception of logic all the way up to the end of the Latin Middle Ages. And that's when the history of forgetting begins, right? As I already mentioned, when people really started thinking more and more about logic in mentalistic terms. And then, you know, that leads us, you know, through Descartes and Kant all the way to what is still, I guess, the received view of logic as primarily pertaining to thought and mental processes, right? And I also looked briefly at these other logical traditions. And I mean, I want to say, you know, from the start, I'm not an expert in any way in Indian or Chinese logic. So I got a lot of help from people who do know their stuff on these traditions. But I really felt that it was very important to include, right, these other narratives, especially because, I mean, I think it's just a scandal, right, that we're still thinking of philosophy in such a parochial way, not only looking at like the, you know, European tradition and its ramifications. But then also another reason to talk about the Indian and the Chinese philosophy is because they actually strengthen my case.
Yeah.
These traditions, they also, you know, it's also clear that there too, logic and emerges very much from dialogical practices of debating, and in different ways, right? So both the Indian tradition and the Chinese tradition are quite different from each other and from the Greek tradition. But in all three of them, you see this strong connection between dialogues and logic and deduction. So, well, deduction only really not perhaps articulated in the same way as in the Greek sense, but certainly these dialogical practices and principles of logic. So I thought it was important also to include that in the book and and to show that there are like these alternative ways of, you know, developing these concepts, but there's also some convergence there.
Right, right. Could you, as I was reading that the section is particularly on Indian logic. I was reminded of, you know, a wonderful essay that you do mention, Amartya Sen's essay on the argumentative Indian.
Oh, yes, that's beautiful, yes.
So can you tell us just a little bit more, though, about something that you said explicitly with respect to Plato and Aristotle and the interest in logic as and the interest in deduction as a response to certain social and political characteristics that follow out of democratic self-government, particularly, you know, we're used to thinking of Socrates versus the Sophists, and that's definitely a politically intoned dispute. Can you tell us a little bit more about the social and political aspects of the dialogical account of deduction?
Yes, really the story is that, and again, this is a story that's been told by other people, Ravi Onetz, Jeffrey Lloyd, right? So I'm really relying on a lot of scholarship that has already been done by other people. So it's really this idea that you have there's this background of, the background of the Athenian democracy where people have to be good orators, right? Have to be persuasive. And then there's the sophists, presumably, who emphasized long speeches, right? Who really thought that, well, you know, this is the best way to be persuasive is to come up with these very long speeches in the assembly, and then you get people to, you know, vote for you. And of course, this is something that Plato criticizes very, very much, right? In the Republic, sure. And in the Gorgias, and in many other places. And then Plato himself said, well, you know, in the mouth, using Socrates as his mouthpiece. He says, well, this is not really, I don't like this model of the long speeches. We should do something else. We should actually do like these dialogues, you know, with short alternating bouts, right? So I say something, you say something back, and you, right? So we alternate much more. And they really kind of, this was in a sense a rejection of the sophist model, which in turn Plato's rejection of the whole idea of democracy is very much tied also to the historical circumstances, right? They had just had that horrific wars, right, of the Peloponnese, and they had lost, right? And so, and then, so somebody like Plato is looking around and thinking, hey, democracy got us in a lot of trouble, right? It just made us really kind of like, we started out as like the hot kids in town, and now we're just the underdogs. So I think that this critical stance towards democratic practices, which in turn they associated with this style of discourse based on rhetoric, on long speeches and all that, so there was a rejection of all this, very much also motivated by the demise of Athens, right, as a result of these wars. And so then instead that there's this other model, which is much more dialectical, right, the dialectical, where people take turns when they speak. And that really kind of gave rise to this way of arguing, which is what you see in, say, Plato's dialogues, and then later got regimented by Aristotle in the Topics. So that's kind of the thought here, right? That there's really this, as a reaction to a particular discursive mode, then came this kind of more dialogical mode of engagement, which in turn then led to the development, for example, of the syllogistic system by Aristotle.
Mm-hmm. Fabulous, fabulous. So the third part of the book talks about some of the cognitive research with respect to how actual, you know, embodied, socially embedded thinking creatures go about inferring new things from things that they already accept or know. And I take it that one advantage of your dialogical view about deduction is that it's able to accommodate some of the more unflattering results from this kind of empirical study. You know, when we're thinking of deduction and deductive inference and validity as the sort of gold standard of thought, of, you know, of some kind of rationality that's, you know, somewhere behind the eyes and between the ears.
Yes.
You know, it's sort of it's a little disconcerting to discover how bad we are at it.
Yeah, what to make of that, right? Yes, exactly.
That's right. So you see how bad we are at the Waysan selection task, and how easily we commit certain kinds of just straightforward formal fallacies. You know, it starts looking, the portrait that emerges of human thinking is starts looking pretty depressing. But your view takes a different account of all of this. And so can you tell us a bit about first some of the disconcerting or troubling results from the empirical study, and then how the dialogical view might not be so depressing as some of the other models are?
Right. Well, yes. I mean, this body of research really started in the 60s with Waysan. The pioneer, right? When people started running these experiments with deductive reasoning tasks and started to realize that people did really badly, right? That it was dismal, right? People's deductive capacities, at least in these artificial settings, right, of experiments in the laboratory. And then people really struggled for decades, with these experimental psychologists, to make sense of what was going on. And that's where also this whole literature on reasoning biases has emerged, mm-hmm. because people then observed that the mistakes, right, quote-unquote mistakes that people made were not random, right? There was systematicity in these mistakes. And that, so there's, of course, this whole tradition of heuristics and biases from the Tversky-Kahneman tradition, which is more, has to do more with probabilities, etc. But it really very much kind of goes together with what was happening in the psychology of reasoning literature. And so people started thinking, well, you know, like, what do we make of this, right? So are we using... and still using logic, in particular syllogistic and conditionals like modus ponens and all this, as the normative canon, right, to evaluate the reasoning performance of participants. And then people started to think, you know, what do we make of this? And so what happened eventually is that, and now this has really, nobody thinks anymore that, you know, that deductive logics are a good descriptive model of how people actually reason. And so what people from by and large now think is that reasoning, human reasoning in the wild, as it were, is essentially defeasible and non-monotonic, right? So it really operates with principles that are very, very different from the principles, the canons of deductive reasoning, which is indefeasible and monotonic.
Right.
And so then how exactly you describe this, there are discussions, should you use non-monotonic logics, should you use Bayes and probabilities, right? So this is still a discussion. But at the same time that people seem to do very badly, typically in these reasoning experiments, at least, you know, on average, right? They're always like some people do well. There's quite some individual variation, but still, right? I mean, by and large, people don't do very well. But at the same time, some other people were conducting similar experiments, but letting people solve deductive tasks in groups, right? And what was interesting was that suddenly when you're dealing with kind of logical questions, what people notice is that if you put people in groups to discuss, and solve these puzzles, they actually get things right, way more right in the deductive sense of right. So that is already, I think, a vindication of the whole idea, the dialogical conception of deduction, because, right, it seems that when people really discuss with each other and look at the pros and cons and write and analyze reasons together, do what Bob Branham calls the giving and asking for reasons, mm-hmm. they really kind of come, you know, find many the right deductive solution much more often than when they're doing it on their own. So that really is already an indication that people, if you present the deductive reasoning as a particular language game, right, to use a Wittgensteinian term, which is very specific to these kind of ways of interacting with each other that are not intended to just zoom into, say, what, you know, the most plausible model to the both of us, but rather to really see all the possibilities and consider all the different models. And if we do that together, reasoning performance improves. So that really seems to be good news for both for us as humans and for my hypothesis, my dialogical hypothesis. So in the end, what you see is that, you know, in these reasoning tasks in the lab, people don't really understand what game they're supposed to play, right? I mean, they're not right. Really, it's not clear they're playing the game of reasoning kind of, you know, under defeasible circumstances and all this, which is what we do in daily life. But whereas, you know, the deductive game is a cognitive oddity, right? To ask people to reason following patterns of indefeasibility, right? And do monotonic reasoning. This is a cognitive oddity. But if put in the right context, if you explain to people, look, this is the game we're playing here. We want to rule out all possible exceptions, right? So that whenever the premises are the case, the conclusion also has to be the case. When that is made clear to people, to reasoners, they actually are able to reason deductively more, at least they do better than they would otherwise. So by and large, it's really a matter of not having been clear on what language game they should have been playing in the first place.
Right. You know, I remember, again, I can't even remember the source, but I had thought that there were some results that college kids do better on the Waisson selection task when the task is framed in terms of being old enough to get into a bar or something.
That's right. There's that, yes. This is something I've actually worked on in my previous book, Informal Languages and Logic, which is that people are not very good at reasoning with what these experimentalists call abstract material. Right. So if you're just giving them letters and numbers and stuff, right, for the Waisson selection task, people don't do very well. But if you formulate in terms of the question is, if you're younger than the official drinking age, right, in some places 18 and the other places in the US 21, then you shouldn't be drinking. And then people understand much better that they should turn both the card of the antecedent and then the negation of the consequence. But that's that has to do with the idea that if you give it content, right, rather than just in the abstract, people already do better. Yeah.
It's a testament to how important it is for college kids to drink.
Absolutely. Yeah. This is it's a matter of life or death. So you got to know this stuff. Yeah.
So, Katerina, you've been really generous with your time. I wanted to make sure we got to talk about a distinction that you draw in the third part of the book and mentioned earlier between the ontogeny and phylogeny of deductive reasoning. Can you tell us a little bit about how those two sort of lenses for thinking about the roots sort of play into the account?
Sure. In fact, I also introduce a third one, which is the historical one, right?
Because right.
The phylogenetic timescale is really, all the way back. So how do we even come to be able to learn how to reason deductively? What are the cognitive antecedents which are related to our evolutionary story that make it possible for us to reason, right? To learn, first of all, to reason at all, and then to reason deductively specifically. And here, of course, I'm responding to work, for example, by Mercier and Sperber, who have some ideas that are quite similar to mine, but in some respects, we also disagree. And then the thought here is that it's also important to have a story on how we actually come to be the kinds of beings that can actually learn how to reason deductively, or how, reasoning comes about in humans at all, right? Reasoning understood in a certain way. So that's the the very long, timescale of looking way, way back. Right. Then there's the historical timescale, which is the one that is on record, right? Which is in writing. And that's where this whole part that I was telling you about, the historical emergence of deductive canons in ancient Greece, both in mathematics and in philosophy and logic and all this. This is the historical timescale. And then the ontogenetic timescale is when you just look at one particular individual and you see, ask yourself, how does this person learn how to reason deductively if they learn at all? And this question is, of course, particularly important for mathematics educators. So this is also a literature that I've engaged with quite a lot in the book. Right. So what mathematics educators have said about how, they say that it's difficult for students typically to learn how to write mathematical proofs. Right? That this is just something that people find difficult to do, even students of mathematics. But on the other hand, also many of them have experimented with different ways of teaching the technique of mathematical proof. And if you adopt a dialogical conception, right, a dialogical approach to proof, that it seems to really help students to understand much better what exactly is expected of them when they're, formulating a mathematical proof themselves. So I know, I thought it was important to distinguish these three levels, right? These three kinds of roots, right? One that goes way, way back in time to our, you know, evolutionary past, then the time frame, this the historical time frame, which has to do with these cultural developments, right? That's where the cultural story really kicks in. And then finally, how a particular individual can learn how to reason deductively.
That's fabulous. One last question. What's the next project?
Well, I mean, the project has been going on already for a while, right? Because I started in 2018. I started a project funded by the European Research Council on the social epistemology of argumentation. So basically, just as before in my previous project, I was looking at deductive argumentation specifically. Now I'm looking at argumentation much, much more broadly and including, you know, the different fields in which argumentation takes place. And of course, I then end up also engaging with quite a lot of your work, Bob, of course, right, on deliberation and democracy. But also, I'm also interested in argumentation and science in different scientific domains, right? So I've done a lot of work on argumentation in mathematics specifically, and now I'm also, with the help of a bunch of people, postdocs, PhD students, we're looking at argumentation also in other scientific domains and also looking at argumentation, for example, in politics. So in a sense, it's a natural continuation to the previous project on deduction specifically, but on the other hand, it's much broader, right? It looks at much, much wider range of phenomena. And I'm 3 years into this project, and now I'm starting to think already about the book that I write, where I'll summarize the main results of this project. And this time it's going to be a book not as scholarly, right? I mean, really geared towards a broader audience. I would like the book to be read also by people outside of academia. So that's going to be an interesting challenge, right? It's a different way of writing. You do it very well, right? So maybe I'll take some, you know, inspiration from you. But that's kind of, hopefully I hope to start writing this book this academic year and the next. So hopefully in a few years, there'll be a book on the social epistemology of argumentation.
Well, that sounds very exciting. And I look forward to reading that book when it comes out. But for now, Katerina, thank you for joining me on New Books in Philosophy. It's been really great talking to you.
Well, thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you, listeners, for joining us today on New Books in Philosophy. I remind you that I've been talking to Katerina Dutil-Novais, and we've been talking about Katerina's new book, which is titled The Dialogical Roots of Deduction. The book is just out with Cambridge University Press, and I highly recommend it. Thanks for listening, and bye for now.